precautionary measures have been trained and exercised well in advance of this, so we're confident that the communities were prepared to respond.
Western Alaska braces for a massive storm. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Obama administration lays out plans for offshore leasing in the Arctic Ocean.
Reading between the lines, I think it's fair to say that Shell's success in the Arctic will in some way be a referendum on those future lease sales.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
A Bering Sea storm packing hurricane-force winds and 35-foot waves is hitting the western Alaska coastline. In a few minutes, we'll hear how communities have prepared. But first, we have National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader on the line to give us an update on the storm. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
So what's the latest update? Where is the storm right now, and what does it look like?
The storm is about 250 miles southwest of Gamble. It's in the northern Bering Sea. The weather front associated with this is just pushing into St. Lawrence Island right now and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Right now, it's very close to hurricane force winds. We've got 70-mile-an-hour gusts now at Savunga and close to that at Gamble on St. Lawrence Island, and down on the Yukon Delta, winds are pretty close to that as well.
Beyond the concern about St. Lawrence Island communities, what other communities in Alaska are going to be hit the hardest?
Well, some have already been hit. St. Paul Island had near hurricane force gusts. The weather front has gone by there. It's hitting basically the whole west coast of mainland Alaska. So really from Bristol Bay all the way up to Point Lay, and it'll eventually affect Wainwright as well.
Well, I'm sure it's hard to predict at this point in time, but what type of damage do you expect?
Well, we're expecting 50 to 70 mile an hour winds along the entire west coast, but we're actually expecting gusts as high as 100 miles an hour at St. Lawrence Island and in the Bering Strait. And we've had winds of 70 miles an hour at Point Hope as well. So some of those strong winds could cause damage to homes and other buildings out there. Then in addition to that, as the weather front goes by, the winds turn a little bit more southerly. We're expecting a storm surge to move into much of the west coast from the Bering Strait southward. And so that'll raise sea levels anywhere between 4 and 8 feet.
And Jim, how long is this storm expected to last?
The brunt is coming in this evening, and the strongest winds will be tonight into tomorrow. But the storm surge in some areas will last into Thursday. So places like Nome, the water level is coming up, and on the Yukon Delta as well, and the water will remain high there, peaking out tomorrow, but remain high into Thursday. Other areas like eastern Norton Sound, the water level is actually kind of low with offshore flow right now, but the water will come up pretty quickly tomorrow there at places like Unalakleet and remain high into Thursday.
Thank you, Jim, for giving us that update this evening.
You're welcome.
Jim Brader is a National Weather Service meteorologist. Alaska's Division of Homeland Security has been helping western villages prepare for the storm for the last 24 hours. Brian Fisher is incident commander for the division. He says most of the communities have been trained in the last few years on how to respond and prepare for this type of disaster.
Checking your power systems, moving boats away from the shore, preparing your shelters, preparing to evacuate people if you think that that's necessary at the local level. All of those precautionary measures have been trained and exercised well in advance of this, so we're confident that the communities were prepared to respond.
Fisher says the division also trains frequently to respond to fall storms. He says a few villages have set up local shelters that some residents are already taking advantage of. The division will be ready to respond to calls for on-the-ground support as soon as the storm lets up and will also help with damage assessments. Fisher says the timing of the storm increases the potential for damage.
Unfortunately, the timing of the year is such that the sea ice is not there, which causes a potential for greater damage than if there was shore fast ice. So we're going to be prepared to respond to whatever that eventuality is. We've done it in the past where we've had many, many communities all impacted to some degree, and we're preparing for that eventuality if that ends up being the case.
Nome is expected to be one of the hardest hit communities. KNOM's Ben Matheson has that story.
Winds are picking up this afternoon in Nome as the storm moves in. Floodwaters are a top concern in Nome, with the main Front Street business area located directly on the Bering Sea. Charlie Lean from the local emergency planning committee says the seawall can hold around 18 feet of water. As bigger waves hit, water can splash over.
4.5 to 5 feet of water that's going to slop over on each wave, which can do damage and will likely put ice and debris on Front Street.
The Nome Emergency Operations Center has issued evacuation orders for low-lying areas, including the downtown Front Street area and neighborhoods near the port. Nome Incident Commander Chip Leeper.
The police department has just finished up doing a walkthrough at West Beach. They've contacted residents that were still living there. They are in the process of relocating. They have been notified. And then as we speak, the fire department is hitting the low-lying areas around Nome.
The order is expected to remain in effect for 48 hours. The Nome Recreation Center is opening as the primary shelter for displaced families. Leeper says volunteers will also be closing off hazardous areas.
We have some barricades we're going to set up to keep people out of those areas because the storm is a pretty awesome event in scope and in power. So obviously there's a lot of curiosity on the parts of local citizens. They want to get as close as possible. They want to get down on the beach. Obviously that's not safe, and we want to kind of dissuade them as much as we can.
Across the Norton Sound area, Gamble, St. Michael, and Savoonga each have had a handful of residents voluntarily evacuate to the school gym. Several communities closed down school early today and opened the gym as emergency shelters. Little Diomede is expecting hurricane-force winds and waves at high tide hitting 28 feet. Residents are concerned about losing power, which could take several days to restore. The community of Kivalina is located on an island in the Chukchi Sea and has dealt with major floods and erosion in the past. City Manager Janet Mitchell says the community is depending on a 14-foot rock revetment wall to protect structures from the storm surge. The school is situated 19 feet above sea level and will be the emergency shelter. Volunteers parked a loader and boats by the school should they be needed to rescue people from their homes. Mitchell says power lines are also a concern and they have already been impacted by the storm.
We've already had one power line area spark early this morning, about 7, and they've already taken care of it.
Across the region, volunteers and emergency personnel have been working around the clock to prepare for the storm. On Front Street in Nome, windows are boarded up as the surge moves in and winds to 47 miles an hour rock power lines back and forth. Residents are seeing the first stages of the system. The worst of the storm should hit tonight. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
In Kotzebue, Wendy Schaefer is the community incident commander. She says winds are picking up. Schaefer says although there is concern for all villages in the borough, a lot of that concern is focused on Kivalina and Deering.
We do have some concern with high water surges in Deering, so we've been taking a lot of precautions with the community of Deering as well.
And what's the mood in the community of Kotzebue? Are people... Do people seem afraid, or are they just going about the business of preparing for a bad storm?
I think there seems to be a little bit more concern that the storm is projected to be so large. However, people seem to be taking local precautions and preparing, securing things around their homes to prevent additional projectiles, creating additional hazards if the winds or when the winds pick up. Purchasing additional water and stockpiling additional water, produce and vegetables and stuff like that to make sure that they have enough food within the home, contacting the local clinic to get medications on refills. checking on elders. Our search and rescue crew locally in Cotsview is going to be contacting a list of elders to make sure that they're okay.
And it sounds like folks are preparing quite well. How well prepared would you say Cotsview residents are for riding out what could be a long stretch with no power or access to essential supplies?
Overall, I think Cotsview residents are pretty well prepared. You have to remember that we don't go to the store for most of our food. It's traditionally harvested, and so we have not necessarily the 72 hours of stockpile of food that FEMA or the Homeland Security recommends. We usually have like an 8-month supply. So, they're taking some additional precautions, but overall, I think people are there's some a level of concern, but overall, they're kind of doing what they need to do to be ready to hunker down and wait out the storm, which is only anticipated to be about an 18-hour period. But the after portion of that storm, the recovery phase is the response and recovery phase will be greater in clearing the roads and restoring power if need be.
Wendy Schaefer is the incident commander for Kotzebue in the Northwest Arctic Borough. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, smaller logging operations are changing the industry in Southeast.
We're now working and operating at a scale that is appropriate for the community, and it's needed in the community.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The Coast Guard has evacuated most of the crew of the 140-foot Catcher processor, Rebecca Irene. The ship contacted the Coast Guard early this morning to report that they had lost power in one engine and had limited propulsion. Winds of up to 55 miles an hour and seas of up to 35 feet are expected for this evening in the area near Unimak Pass, where the vessel is reported to be. The Coast Guard cutter Sherman evacuated 20 non-essential members of the 34-person crew earlier this afternoon in relatively calm winds and seas. The 14 crew members who remain on board the vessel will probably face some rough conditions later today. Although the boat is headed for shelter in Yarilla Bay on the north side of Unimak Island, it is only traveling at 6 miles an hour and will have to weather the storm in open seas. There are 270,000 pounds of frozen fish in the Rebecca Irene's holds. The vessel is equipped with survival suits and 3 life rafts. The Obama administration is giving a tentative green light to oil and gas lease sales in the Arctic as part of its new 5-year plan. It's calling for one lease sale in both the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, and also one farther south in Cook Inlet near Anchorage. But the plan is drawing criticism from Republicans who want more development and environmentalists who say it's too much. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The Interior Department's proposed 5-year leasing plan calls for Arctic sales, but not right away. And Secretary Ken Salazar says the timing's important. The Beaufort Sea sale is scheduled for 2015, and the Chukchi would be a year later. Salazar says that gives a buffer of time to figure some more things out, like how to clean up oil spills in icy waters, and if there is an accident, how to stage a major cleanup in a remote part of the world with no deep ports or coastal fleets.
They are scheduled under our program, late in the program, to allow time for further study and infrastructure development and addressing other issues which are important for the unique conditions that we face in this frontier area. In frontier areas such as the Arctic, we know that we must proceed cautiously, safely, and based on the best science available. as government and industry work to develop infrastructure.
The director of the Interior Department's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Tommy Boudreau, detailed the plans for a lease sale in Alaska's Cook Inlet. He says he grew up in Anchorage, looking at development platforms out on the inlet, but those are in state waters. And Boudreau says this would allow exploration in federal waters.
The Cook Inlet, by our estimate, includes a lot of natural gas plays. Historically, there just hasn't been that much interest in pursuing those plays in Alaska as opposed to other areas in the country. But that interest may be changing and may be growing. One operator in particular, Apache, has recently expressed interest.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, the top Republican on the Energy Committee, calls the proposed Alaska leases a positive sign, but says the proof will come in the permitting process. GOP Congressman Don Young says it's a step in the right direction, but complains that the White House isn't being as aggressive as the Bush administration was. Other Republicans were more critical, chiding the Interior Department for not creating enough oil and gas industry jobs. But environmental groups are voicing their own criticism of the White House. Lois Epstein, an engineer and the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society, calls the decision a mixed bag and used the word disappointed to describe her reaction. Epstein and other environmentalists doubt there will be significant enough improvements in knowledge about Arctic drilling in the window before 2015.
The infrastructure is still not going to be there. There's not going to be adequate science in a few years. There's not going to be tested and proven spill response equipment. So our view is that it's a bit of a rosy picture they're painting about what the situation is going to be in 2015, and more likely than not, they're not going to be any more ready to be drilling then than they are now.
This week's announcement is focused on the new 5-year lease plan, but it doesn't go back and change or erase leases already sold. That means oil company Shell could still go ahead with its plans for exploration in Arctic waters this summer if it gets final approval. Interior Deputy Secretary David Hayes explains.
What we are processing now are leases that were sold 5 years ago under the prior administration, four or five years ago. And companies purchased those leases, and we have made clear that we believe there's an obligation to diligently proceed and evaluate requests to develop those leases since they have been purchased by those companies.
Environmentalist Lois Epstein says it doesn't make sense to move cautiously on the next round of lease sales while letting Shell go forward.
There is a contradiction there because they're saying they're going to go forward with exploratory drilling, which is and can be riskier even than production. And they say they don't have enough information to for sure hold those lease sales in the next few years.
Shell Alaska spokesman Curtis Smith says a lot may ride on how things go for his company when it's allowed to proceed.
Reading between the lines, I think it's fair to say that our success, Shell's success in the Arctic, will in some way be a referendum on those future lease sales, not just in terms of them being available for bidding, but also the price they might demand.
The Interior Department's David Hayes says the proposed 5-year plan is not etched in stone, so what is learned or not learned, and how things go if Shell moves forward could influence what happens next.
There is potential flexibility for either delaying or increasing the lease sales in the Arctic, depending on what information is developed in the meantime.
Officials will hold 9 hearings in Alaska next month to take comments on the proposal in communities like Anchorage and Fairbanks and those on the front lines like Wainwright, Kaktovik, and Barrow. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Everything you ever wanted to know about the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation will soon be online. The Alaska State Archives has received federal funds to evaluate and make accessible state litigation documents stemming from the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. Larry Hipsman is the senior archivist at the Alaska State Archives, and he's directing the project. In 5 years of litigation, he says the Alaska Department of Law accumulated millions of pages of documents about the spill.
The project is meant to organize Department of Law litigation records that were created during the Exxon Valdez oil spill, put it in our internal electronic catalog, and then upload it to a online bibliographic system, which is basically a bibliographic catalog.
Archivists started the project on October 1st after receiving nearly $110,000 in funding for the project from the National Historic Publications and Records Commission. Hipsman says archivists are determining what to keep for permanent public knowledge and what to dispose of. He says preserving the documents is important.
The Exxon Valdez oil spill was a decisive world event, but it permanently changed lives of those of us who live in Alaska, especially in the spill region, and having access to this material, particularly for the public, will support public right to know and will assure that the event is never overlooked or forgotten.
Individual documents from the litigation have been available through public information requests, but you had to know exactly what you wanted. The archiving project will make online catalogs available for the documents for the first time. The project is scheduled for completion in the fall of 2013. The gale logging might be gone from northern southeast Alaska, but across the region, people are turning to smaller timber sales to earn a living. Officials hope the model can support local economies in the region, and for one family in Tenneke Springs, the effort has paid off. KCAW's Ed Ronco has this profile.
Gordon Chu runs a small logging operation in Corner Bay, just across the inlet from Tenneke Springs, and it keeps him pretty busy. So busy, in fact, that when I arrive in Tenneke Springs on a Monday morning, Chu says he doesn't have time to stop for an interview, but that I can borrow his adult son's bicycle and talk to him as we ride down to the harbor together. In the interest of my own safety, I wait until we get to his boat before I reach for the microphone.
Gordon, how would you describe your work, what you do?
Well, it's pretty varied. We have to do a little bit of everything between all the boating and barging and lumber milling and logging and construction and restoration around town.
Chu runs the Tenneke Logging Company, and he's part of the changing face of the lumber industry. In this part of southeast Alaska, large-scale logging doesn't exist anymore, but smaller, selective cuts, like the 100,000 or so board feet each year that Chu takes from the Tongass, are becoming more popular. Chu's company logs, but it also builds. He uses the timber taken from Corner Bay on projects in Tenneke Springs. As we leave the harbor, he opens up the throttle and heads to the fuel dock. There's a 55-gallon drum in the back of the boat.
I've got a barrel here I'd like to fill with number two. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll be right up.
The fuel will go over to Corner Bay to feed the company's truck, but not far from where we're tied up is the Snyder Mercantile, a general store dating back to 1899. Chu and his team are working to restore the old building along with its adjacent property using wood that they've harvested and milled. Chu says that part of the business is essential.
The foundation under that warehouse there, those are all hemlock pilings. So we drag a lot of them over here as pilings. Also under the store, the old part of the store is all restored with yellow cedar pilings. I'm not sure if we could manage it on our timber sales alone. The fact that we get to work with the timber as builders is what makes it lucrative for us. It's not selling the timber.
His operation is definitely unique in our Ranger District.
Zia Brukaya works for the Sitka Conservation Society.
Throughout southeast Alaska, there are lots of small mills that are operating, to different degrees. Some of them, I think, are doing construction as well as milling like Gordon is. Some of them are just doing milling, putting together cabin kits and things, but they're all working at that smaller scale of, you know, a few hundred thousand board feet per year.
The Conservation Society and other environmental groups in Southeast have taken an interest in operations like CHOOSE because they say they're smart, sustainable ways to use the Tongass. It was never logging outright that was the problem, Bukaya says. It was the scale of what happened in years past.
We're now working and operating at a scale that is appropriate for the community, and it's needed in the community.
Brukaya says it's also an opportunity to build up the local economy for the benefit of local residents, a way to keep people living in Southeast, especially in small, remote communities where the loss of even a family or two can be felt throughout town. And few are more aware of that than Chris Budke, a forestry technician in the U.S. Forest Service's Hoonah office.
Like every time I turn around, I read something in the paper, or I see a reason, or I look at people, and I see lots of reasons for people to be leaving Southeast Alaska.
He lists off the reasons. It's a harsh environment, goods and services are expensive, and more. But he says offering opportunities to run small businesses using Tongass resources might help keep people around.
If we can work with local people that are using local products and meet the objective of everybody, which is really difficult, by the way, and provide a product for those people that they can turn around and make a living off of, that, to me, that gives you reasons to be here.
And giving people reasons to be here can have big implications for Southeast, which is hemorrhaging population.
This is incredibly important for people to be working. It's incredibly important for us to be using our natural resources. It's incredibly important to people understand that we can use it responsibly. So we can meet the objectives of a lot of things here and give people a reason to stay in Southeast.
Gordon Chu and his family are examples of that. They saw Alaska during a trip in 1995 and loved it so much that they went back south and made plans to move up. They returned in 99 and have been here since. Back in Tenneke Springs, Chu's 55-gallon drum is nearly full of number 2 diesel. He taps off the nozzle.
Thank you, Eve.
All right, guys. Have a good one.
All right.
And as it's being hoisted back onto the fuel dock, he says there's a future in the kind of small-scale logging he does, not only for places like Tenneke Springs, but for the entire region. For now, though, it's back to work. There's a truck waiting in Corner Bay, and a 55-gallon drum of fuel that has Chu's boat riding a little low in the water.
I better go like hell or else I'm going to sink.
All right, I'll let you go.
Reporting from Tenneke Springs, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Dacia Eaton in Dillingham, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Our web editor is Josh Edge. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. November is National Family Caregivers and Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Are you one of the thousands of Alaskans who provide care for a family member who is chronically ill, elderly, or has a disability? Well, there are resources and help for you and your loved one. For information, visit alaskaaging.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Aging and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.